Breaking news, and this one is almost unbelievable.
Yeah, it's all about new customers at Bet365, because they get $150 in bonus bets when they bet $5, win or lose. And even better, bonus bets can be used on the spread, totals, and player props.
There you have it. Bet $5 to get $150 in bonus bets, win or lose. And see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. T&Cs apply. Available in app only.
Coverage varies by plan. View contracts and exclusions at endurancewarranty.com.
If you're driving a car or truck with an expired warranty and suddenly lost your transmission or needed a full engine repair, would a $4,000 repair bill leave you stranded? I'm Danica Patrick. Don't get caught off guard with a vehicle breakdown. Choose the company I trust. Endurance. No matter the mileage, if your vehicle is less than 20 years old, Endurance offers comprehensive auto protection plans for any budget. Protection on the drivetrain, electrical, transmission, AC, and more. Plus, benefits like 24/7 roadside assistance and rental car reimbursement on any plan. Endurance handles everything from making the claim through the repair process to paying the certified mechanic of your choice. Don't get caught off guard with a vehicle breakdown. Act now and get one full year of elite benefits, a $2,000 value, free.
Visit endurancewarranty.com for your fast free quote today. That's endurancewarranty.com.
Hey, this is Jeremy from Keeping It Strong Style. What you're about to listen to is episode one of Ta-Nehisi, Ace of the Universe, which is a Patreon exclusive series that we are doing on the Keeping It Strong Style Patreon over at patreon.com/KIStrongStyle. We are making the first episode available for free on our Keeping It Strong Style feed. So check out the first episode of the series done by the young boy, Josh Smith. This will be a 28-part series with a new episode coming out every week. So you can get the first episode for free here on our feed or over at the Patreon. You can also get the first episode free. And then you can join the grade one tier, which is $5 a month. That will get you access to this series and any other bonus audio we do. Also, you'll get this show ad-free every week. So go ahead and sign up at patreon.com/KIStrongStyle and check out this great series.
That's because you've been dealing with the Ace.
Are listening to Ta-Nehisi, Ace of the Universe, Volume 1, 1999, presented to you by Keeping It Strong Style in conjunction with the Social Suplex Podcast Network. This is the young boy, Joshua Smith, welcoming you to the show. And if you're listening, you may be listening on our free feed for the debut episode to kind of give you a preview and a taste of what's in store. Or if you are listening as part of our Patreon, which the remaining 27 episodes will be hosted on the Keeping a Strong Style Patreon page. Thank you for your patronage. And this is just to kind of give you guys an understanding and a taste of what this project is, what it looks like, and how it's going to proceed moving forward. For those of you that listen to the show, you probably know I've taken a hiatus from Keeping It Strong Style. I will be back this coming week. So right now I'm recording on June the 12th at 11 a.m. Eastern. And, you know, coming up here in the very near future on Monday, we'll be reviewing Dominion. So I will be returning to the show, but this is the first audio that I've done in about 4 weeks. For those of you that have reached out to check on my status and how I'm doing, I appreciate you folks reaching out, and I'm happy to be back recording audio for you guys. And I'm super excited to be doing this particular project because it is a passion project of mine. As many of you know, Hiroshi Tanahashi is one of my absolute favorite all-time pro wrestlers, just like he is for many of you. And when it was announced that he would be retiring, you know, in early January of 2026, I got the idea that, you know, we needed to maybe catalog and conceptualize and you know, just kind of review what he has done throughout the course of his career. So that was sort of the genesis and birth of this project and what it's going to be looking like for those of you that are listening. We're going to go through year by year for each year of Hiroshi Tanahashi's active in-ring career. We're going to analyze things like what major news stories were taking place within New Japan as a whole, and maybe even per Rezu if it's a big enough story. Because realistically, the story of Hiroshi Tanahashi over the past 27 years or so has been the story of New Japan Pro Wrestling. So we're going to talk about major ongoing news stories, major shows that have occurred. We're not going to go super in depth. We're talking broad strokes. I'm not going to put all of those things into complete in-depth historical perspective for you, but we will be mentioning kind of what was going on in each of these years and how that reflects and, you know, just kind of compares to what was going on with Tanahashi in his in-ring career and where he was in the status of his career. We'll be talking about some of the major stories that took place throughout the year. I'll be analyzing where we're at in terms of the IWGP heavyweight title, its history, what records have been set, and as we go along talking about how those were broken. We'll briefly discuss G1 winners, and we'll be talking about the state of that IWGP title each year. What was going on? Who were the champions? When did they defend those titles? Against who? Etc., etc. But the biggest thing is that the focus here is going to be on Hiroshi Tanahashi, his records, his comparisons to his compatriots and contemporaries, how he was doing against veterans, the tournaments that he participated in, the title matches, the stories, the rivalries. I will be selecting two matches from each year. Maybe, you know, in 2002, I'm thinking, and in 04, I'm thinking maybe three. It just depends, but there will always be at minimum two matches that we'll review. And I'll let you know where those matches are available online so that you can view them and take a look for yourself and kind of get your own perspective and follow along with this project. But for this first episode for Tanahashi, Ace of the Universe, we're going to be doing a lot of background because before we can talk about his in-ring career, we have to talk about who Hiroshi Tanahashi was, what we know of him, what his experiences were, and what led to him becoming the, you know, Pro Wrezu star that we know and love today. So getting started here, let's start off with Tanahashi and his background. So Hiroshi Tanahashi was born on November 13th, 1976 in Ogaki City, Gifu Prefecture. I always struggle with that word. He was the eldest of three kids, and if you know anything about the layout of Japan, Ogaki City, that's the countryside. So, you know, Tanahashi, he grew up in a family of three kids, two parents living on the countryside, very much apart from the big city life that he would come to know in his wrestling days. And most of the information that I'll be providing to you, a lot of this has been, for lack of a better word, I guess aggregated, but it's been researched off the backs of the work that many other people have done, you know, so the writings of Chris Charlton in both Lion's Pride as well as Eggshells. There's an incredible life story of Hiroshi Tanahashi that's been made available on the NJPW 1972 website called Ace is High, which is an interview series translated to English about his entire life experience. And that's where a good portion of the information that we're getting here today comes from, but also lots of research that's been done online through various websites. Cage Match is an invaluable resource. Also the guys over at, Speaking of Strong Style with the Fight Game Media podcast, they did a Tanahashi retrospective earlier this past year, which would probably be a really good complimentary episode to listen to. They compiled numerous aspects of a retrospective on Tanahashi's career. I do think that what we're doing here will be a little more in depth, but that's a really great listen as well. And if you haven't checked those guys out, I highly recommend it. But Tanahashi was a self-professed class clown, class clown growing up, and sort of had a personality where he would show out and try to be the center of attention. In terms of his exposure to professional wrestling, his grandmother exposed him to the world of Pro Rezu at a young age, and he grew up watching World Pro. But by his own admission, pro wrestling as a young, as a, you know, in his young age was not his primary passion or even something that he was super into. It was more of a peripheral sort of, you know, interest of his. His big passion growing up was baseball. He grew up as a fan of the Chunichi Dragons. He idolized players like Kenichi Yazawa, Tatsu Komatsu, and Genji Gaku. And that led him into the path of his career, where he started playing baseball in the fifth grade. He followed that path all throughout his high school career. He played at Ogaki Nishi High School, and he did aspire to go pro, which was the main driving force of his athletic endeavors as a young child and as a teenager. You know, throughout the years, if you read those stories that are on the Aces High interview series, he has a lot of anecdotal stories about unrequited loves, chasing and dating women. And, you know, many of those stories involve him chasing multiple girls at the same time and sort of, you know, always being very female centric, which is noteworthy because obviously in 2001, we're going to talk about the stabbing incident that took place, which was a transformative life experience. And you can kind of see some of those early, I would say, patterns emerging in some of his anecdotal childhood stories. If you ever get a chance to read that series, he tells a funny story about being double suplexed in school by some of his classmates before he was even well-versed in Pro Rezu, which is kind of a funny story because those individuals, those classmates of his that double suplexed him in the hallway, they did that at the height of Pro Rezu booming in the 90s, when he himself maybe wasn't even aware of what the inner workings of Japanese pro wrestling entailed. And they had no idea that they were suplexing a future IWGP heavyweight champion. And, you know, he started really training seriously for athletic endeavors in junior high school to better his baseball and to attract girls. But he wound up giving up his high school baseball dream after his team failed to make the national tournament that year. And one of the things that he mentions is that no matter how much he trained, no matter how good he tried to be, it didn't seem to further his athletic career. Like, he got in better shape. He definitely did well in like gym class and attracted girls. But in terms of his baseball career, he couldn't get to where he needed to be to become an elite player. He did eventually transition his attention to potentially becoming a journalist that could cover baseball. And that's how deep his passion kind of ran. Now, he started to get his first real investment into Japanese professional wrestling around 1992 and 1993, when his younger brother started watching late night professional wrestling, and he got invested watching both New Japan as well as All Japan. And he was a big follower and fan of the Musketeers as well as the Four Pillars. That would be the trio of Keiji Muto, Masahiro Chono, as well as Shinya Hashimoto. And then the Pillars, obviously, Kawada, Taue, Kobashi, and Mizawa. He did mention that he was the biggest fan of Kenta Kobashi and Keiji Muto, as well as Wild Pegasus and Black Tiger 2, and that those four individuals were really the big driving forces of influence on his early wrestling career and how he viewed himself and what impassioned him to eventually become a pro wrestler. Just seeing those types of strong athletic individuals pursue and persist in the face of adversity. And that's what kind of drove him to want to be a star himself, much in the same vein that they were. His favorite match growing up was the Kobashi versus Dr. Death match from August 31st, 1993 in Aichi. That was one of the big foundational moments that really introduced him to potentially pursuing pro wrestling. He also, as a senior in high school, started attending All Japan shows in Gifu, and he was in the Tokyo Dome on October the 9th, 1995, for the UWFI and JPW showdown between Kijimuto and Nobuhiko Takada. And that was, for him, what he stated as being the most influential moment of his fandom, seeing Muto represent Japanese professional wrestling against Takada's shoot-style MMA-centric pro wrestling, and to beat the MMA-centric star with a figure four leg lock and kind of beat him with a pro wrestling submission and beat him right there in the dome. He mentioned that being one of the most raucous crowds he'd ever, been a part of, and that it just really, really, really influenced him in a huge way to kind of inspire him to also become a star just like Kijimuto and do the same thing. After that, he ended up attending every single dome show that occurred in the Tokyo Dome. He even attended every night of the G1 Climax in 1995 in Ryogoku, which those evenings were back to back to back at those at that time. I think it was about five or six nights. That was the tournament where Ric Flair was involved, and Kijimuto would go on to defeat Shinya Hashimoto to win the 1995 G1 Climax as the IWGP champion. The funny story about this is that Hiroshi Tanahashi attended that with no lodging. So he kind of had to find a way to stay awake or to find some sort of rest and respite all throughout Tokyo without actually having any lodging for all of those evenings. And that's kind of how dedicated he was as a fan. In Kyoto, he and his friends, they would attend gyms where the wrestlers would work out. And so they'd go to the shows and they would arrange to be in the gym when certain wrestlers would work out so that they could observe them lift and kind of emulate what they were doing and maybe even rub shoulders with them, take photos with them. And he mentioned being able to get pictures with some of those wrestlers at different times. Fast forwarding, Hiroshi Tanahashi attended Ritsumeikan University, which is one of the most prestigious law programs and universities in all of Japan. The list of notable alumni ranges the full gamut of princes, royalty, CEOs, business venture capitalists, philosophers, artists. Some of the most acclaimed and established individuals have attended that university. And the funny thing is, Tanahashi going to Ritsumeikan University is how he was able to transition into professional wrestling. I don't know that too many people's story is that they go to a law school, of the Ivy League caliber and transition to professional wrestling, but that's exactly what Hiroshi Tanahashi did. While he was in school, he got involved with amateur pro wrestling clubs. And if you're not familiar with what those are, there is a culture in Japan where people will attend colleges and universities and join these amateur pro wrestling clubs. And what they are, it's where students who are super fans of professional wrestling start to emulate pro wrestling and train in the craft of pro wrestling, not amateur folk style wrestling, but actual pro wrestling. Very similar to like backyard or independent, backyard wrestling, what you've seen here in the States, except this is done with a bit more panache and polish. Now, they don't run shows regularly. Most of these clubs maybe have one to two, maybe three shows at most. And most of the students take on a persona or a gimmick that emulates what other famous professional wrestlers have done in the past. But there is usually one big annual super show where the best performers from these different colleges meet up and put on a big show at Corken Hall for paying attendance. And that's sort of where Tanahashi got his first introduction to professional wrestling. He mentioned going through booths, finding this club, kind of getting conned, being told that people had joined the club at his university and gone pro, but that was not true. No, until him, no one had ever done that before. And they would train on a fairly soft ring and would train with the judo club and learn to take bumps. During this time, he wrestled under an Ultimate Warrior gimmick called Super Metal in university. And he trained and wrestled with a famous comedian, pro wrestlers Razor Ramon Hard Gay and Razor Ramon Real Gay. During this time too, as I mentioned, he originally went to school because he was aiming to become a baseball press journalist. I'm sure his family probably had different ideas of what they'd like him to do, going to a law school, potentially becoming a lawyer, that sort of thing. While he was in school, he also pursued other athletic endeavors. He did like cross-country triathlons. He joined the tennis club so he could meet girls. And then he also got involved with the amateur wrestling folk style club in their school. Now, he mentions that they didn't have enough competitors to form a full team, but that they developed this club, they would still compete, and he wasn't necessarily the greatest amateur wrestler in the world, but as the years went on, he improved, and this even started to draw the attention of the scouts in New Japan Pro Wrestling when they saw him, because by this time, Tanahashi was pretty cut, pretty lean, and a ripped individual. When he left high school, he left school at about 143 pounds, and by his freshman year, he'd put on 176 pounds, mostly muscle. So, you know, Tanahashi had that fantastic physique that he's very much famous for. There was a story where Tanahashi was fired from retail chain for clothing line Mujo because he worked the front desk, and in between helping customers, he would get on the floor and do push-ups. Do sets of push-ups, and one time he was doing that, he got caught by his bosses. He missed being able to help a few people at the register and was given an ultimatum: either stop doing the push-ups or you're fired. And he walked out of the job right then and there. In college, he was a self-described jock, the kind of guy that would walk around with jugs of gallons of water, a whole entire sack full of food, so he's constantly snacking and eating so he could put on size. And he even took jobs as a waiter so he could eat discarded sushi and stuff that was left over in the back, so he can continue to build this physique and help him to pursue his athletic ventures. All the while this was taking place, he had his goal and dream of becoming a professional wrestler. There's a story where Tanahashi stood up in front of his class and everyone was saying what their goal and aspiration was. And he said, "I'm here at Retsumeikan College and I'm going to become a professional wrestler," which didn't necessarily go over well with, the professors, and maybe wasn't exactly what his parents were hoping for. Although he does mention that they were extremely supportive, even if they were a bit worried for his future and concerned for his health. With that being the case, Tanahashi always intended to go to New Japan Pro Wrestling. While he was a fan of All Japan, he mentioned that New Japan had the higher profile on television, was a bit more of a clean cut and well-produced product, and that the wrestlers, the Musketeers, were presented as bigger stars, and that's what he aspired to be. So he always wanted to go to the dojo. He took his first dojo tryout in his second year of school, and his intention was, if he passed, he was going to quit school. He tried out along with a future companion Inui, Wataru Inui, as well as 40 to 50 other individuals. And he mentioned that on this tryout, he as well as Inui were the only two individuals that got through every single workout and were able to complete the entire training, but nobody was accepted that day. And what it really turned out to be was bad timing. And he felt like the trainers that were there, the senior pro wrestlers, they kind of were puffing out their chests, making it seem like, well, you know, we really don't need any of these guys. And they declined everybody. But the truth of the matter is that getting into the dojo, a little bit of that is luck and a little bit of his timing. And he felt like, looking back in retrospect, they probably didn't have the resources to allow the guys to come into the lodging. And what that probably has to do with, he mentioned, is probably expecting certain individuals who were already in the dojo to graduate and move on, and then that not happening, but the tryout was already established, so you can't cancel the tryout. These guys come into Tokyo, they're doing the tryout, but they don't have the means to house them, so nobody gets through. He did tell a funny story where he thought that of everyone in that tryout, Inui was the guy that he was most impressed with, and he thought that he would at least definitely get through, because when they were doing their sets of squats and push-ups and different calisthenics, when they would tell them to stop, Inui just kept going, so much so that Riki Choshu had to yell at Inui to tell him to stop doing sets. Tanahashi was very frustrated by this experience. He met with the referee who was at one of the stands at one of the pro wrestling shows, and he asked him, like, hey, I completed everything and I didn't get through. I didn't feel like it was fair. And they told him, well, if that's the case, maybe you should try it again. So he reached out to the New Japan office, asked for a second tryout. They arranged for that to take place. He met with Hashimoto and Fujita privately at the dojo. The problem is Tanahashi got sick right before this tryout. He got a terrible case of diarrhea and was throwing up. And when he still went to the workout, but he couldn't complete the tryout, and he failed. He failed on the squats. And he said at this time it was recommended that in order to do the tryout, you needed to be able to do at least 500 squats and bridge for 3 minutes. And Tanahashi said, I could already do 1,000 squats and I could already bridge for 5 minutes, but because of the illness, it was bad timing, and he failed his second tryout. Finally, in November of 1997, Tanahashi goes to his third and final tryout in his junior year of college, and he passes along with Katsuyori Shibata, Wataru Inumi, and a gentleman by the name of Najima, who is still a trainer with New Japan, or was until recently. The individuals that ran that tryout, Riki Choshu, Black Cat, and Kensuke Sasaki. And this was something where Tanahashi was ecstatic and thrilled. He did his first live spar during the tryout with a teenage Katsuyori Shibata. And that's where they don't actually wrestle. They just kind of have them grapple and see what they're made of and see, you know, how they're able to do. And that was his first real interaction, meeting and training with Shibata, who was a teenager at the time. Now, Tanahashi had been aiming at this exact same time to try and get his younger brother, who was 19, to go to the tryout with him. And he felt that his brother was as good, maybe even a better athlete than Tanahashi. And his idea was, we both love wrestling. This is our passion. Maybe we could both get in and become like a brother tag team, you know, and compete professionally together. Unfortunately, his brother got into a serious accident and almost died shortly before this tryout took place. He ended up being okay in the long run, but was never able to go to one of these tryouts or be the same athlete that he was before. And he mentioned this being a very difficult time for both himself as well as his family, because they've got the one child who goes through the cataclysmic injury, and then they've got another kid who's in law school who's now becoming a professional wrestler. Now, through this time, the funny thing is, he passes the graduation, but he doesn't get into the actual university. Riki Choshu tells him, you know what, you can't drop out. You've got another year plus of school, and what if you get injured? You need this law degree. So he required that Tanahashi actually go back to school, finish his degree, delay his training and his entry into the dojo by over a year. So that was a time where these other individuals like Wataru Inui and Katsuyori Shibata actually got to go into the dojo over a year earlier than Tanahashi. So he was kind of playing catch up. He did struggle in school, he mentioned, but he eventually was able to graduate and was able to come to the dojo. Now, he trained for wrestling nonstop that entire year. He finished school basically being over 200 pounds so that he'd be in good shape to get into the dojo. And that's the story of Tanahashi's background. Now, on his first day in the NJPW office, they told him to come through after he graduated, and the office is closed. so he's kind of frustrated a little bit there. He gets to Tokyo. The doors are closed. The office is closed. There's nobody there. It's on their off day, and he but he knows enough not to question it or to say anything to anybody, because someone probably made a mistake, but he knows his place and he doesn't want to be, you know, kind of ruffling any feathers. But very soon after that, he comes back to the office the next day. He meets with President Sakaguchi. Tanahashi is introduced to future tag team partner Kenzo Suzuki, and that's his first time meeting Kenzo Suzuki, who's also entering into the dojo. Now, at this time, some of the guys that are in this dojo together would be Togi Makabe, known at the time as Shinya Makabe, Katsuyuki Fujita, Wataru Inui, Kenzo Suzuki, Katsuyori Shibata, and Yoshitaki Yoshi. So there are a lot of huge dudes all in the dojo at the exact same time. He did feel at the time that Kenzo Suzuki was his first major rival in the dojo since he was a former rugby star. He had a huge look. They were giving him a big push. Kind of got special treatment for having been a former rugby player and being older than the other guys. He also felt that at the time, Kenzo Suzuki did not take the training quite as seriously as everybody else. Although he was very dedicated, he was yelled at a lot. And this was usually a time where Tanahashi and the others would take the opportunity for Kenzo Suzuki getting yelled at for them to kind of take rest from having to do the calisthenics and the hard training that they do. Shinya Makabe, being an older guy who'd been in the office and or been in the dojo for a bit longer, was sort of the gym leader and the head senpai. He was a strict trainer, but he also was kind of a softy. He threw dessert parties for the guys when they weren't training. He would kind of give them special treatment, give them treats. Tanahashi did spend the early portion of his time in the dojo rooming with Makabe and Shibata. And there's some funny anecdotes there about those three guys having very different personalities and different temperaments when it came to controlling the AC in a small room with three guys. And usually the battles took place between Makabe and Shibata, Makabe wanting things to be a lot colder, Shibata wanting things to be a lot warmer. At the same time, Shibata was kind of viewed as younger than everybody else, a bit skinnier. He was getting injured because he hadn't built his muscle mass yet, and he was a bit of a loner. Shibata and Tanahashi did kind of bond over their mutual recognition and appreciation for fashion, and they ended up actually being shopping partners and going out and buying clothes together pretty often. Following his time staying in the dojo with those three individuals, he wound up eventually graduating to a room with just him and Kenzo Suzuki. Those two guys formed a very close bond where they kind of shared their dreams and aspirations, and was Kenzo Suzuki was probably his best friend in the dojo during that time frame, which kind of makes sense considering the tag team that they wound up developing together. Eventually, before he debuted, he was Keiji Muto's assistant, which is fortuitous, just considering the fact that Muto is one of his all-time favorite wrestlers. He mentioned that what was nice for him was the fact that Muto traveled abroad quite a bit, and that made things a lot easier for Tanahashi because many of his day-to-day chores and routines and responsibilities were kind of skirted because Muto wasn't always there. When he was there, Muto was a very self-reliant and kind of forward-thinking individual. He wasn't so old school. He didn't require as much from Tanahashi as maybe some of the other veterans.
We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair has got style tips for every home. This is Nicole Byer, helping you make those rooms flyer. Today's style tip: when it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals go wild. Like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Ooh, fierce. This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Ever get the feeling you're being watched online? It's data brokers. They collect your personal info, your browsing habits, where you live, and who you're related to, and then sell it to the highest bidder. Aura helps stop that. Aura automatically removes your personal info from data broker sites and keeps it off. It also monitors the dark web, protects your devices, alerts you to real-time threats, and more. Start your free trial at aura.com/listen. That's aura.com/listen for your free trial.
Instead from their, attendance. With that being the case, though, he formed a good bond with Muto. They trained together a lot, and he mentioned that Muto, despite his size, was one of the strongest individuals in all of New Japan. He could lift as much as Manabu Nakanishi while being much smaller than him. And Tanahashi mentioned that throughout his career, he was never able to lift to the same degree or extent that Keiji Muto could in his prime, which is probably a bit of a blow to the ego. Keiji Muto did get a lot of star treatment. They would go out and have great meals, and obviously Keiji Muto, one of the biggest stars in the country. Tanahashi kind of got that exposure to kind of see what someone in his stature, how they were treated. And oftentimes Tanahashi's role was to kind of sit idly by, make sure people didn't get into too much trouble when they went out in public. Later on, he ended up pulling double duty because he became the attendant for Ricky Choshu, who was the booker and head trainer of the company as well. And he mentioned that Ricky Choshu was a very different personality from Keiji Muto, very, very old school. He required a lot from Tanahashi, taking off his boots, doing his laundry, etc., etc. There is a funny anecdote where Ricky Choshu one time had a hair gel bottle explode in his bag and it ruined his towels. And I've heard Tanahashi tell this story two different ways. With wrestlers, this is apt to happen. Sometimes they don't always have the best recollection of what took place. But eventually, the bulk of the story is Ricky Choshu's towel got destroyed. And with that being the case, it was up to Tanahashi to replace that towel. Now, one version of the story says that he grabbed a towel from Keiji Muto that was not in use and replaced it so that he himself didn't face any wrath or anger from his senior, from Ricky Choshu. Another version of the story says that he went home to his father's house and grabbed one of his father's towels to replace it, and had to borrow a towel from another wrestler to replace the towel for his father. I don't know which version 100% is accurate, but both are funny anecdotes and kind of gives you an idea of like what was expected from Tanahashi when it came to attending for both of these guys. One issue that he did tend to run into was the fact that both Muto and Choshu wanted his company and wanted him to go out with them, and he oftentimes preferred going out with Muto because they went to more expensive places and got better treatment, and that would kind of anger Choshu from time to time when he declined his invitation to go out with Muto. Now, at this time, Tanahashi is getting ready to debut, and let's talk about New Japan Pro Wrestling, where they stood at that time in 1999. So leaving 1998, there were two huge shows that took place in the Tokyo Dome. The first one on January 4th, 1998, drawing 65,000 and a half fans. And for the purpose of this project, when I give you how many people attended these major shows, just know that these are not official records. These are the reported records and oftentimes inflated. So keeping in line with the tradition of what was reported, I don't know, have the 100% accurate numbers, but these were what were self-reported, and by all measures, still major shows, even if they're inflated numbers just a bit. But Ricky Choshu retired on that evening for his first retirement. He was retiring to focus on his role as trainer and head booker of New Japan, so that was a huge blow to the company, and did draw one of the largest Tokyo Dome shows ever in its history. Later that month, Giant Baba, the founder of All Japan Pro Wrestling, died on January 31st, which was a huge shakeup to the world of Japanese professional wrestling and All Japan Pro Wrestling, which, you know, New Japan and All Japan, eternal rivals, Baba and Inoki, eternal rivals. And this would really change the course and trajectory of All Japan and Pro Rezu as a whole moving forward. We'll talk more about that. On April 10th, 1998, New Japan hosted the Burning Fighting Spirit Antonio Inoki retirement show, which drew 70,000 fans allegedly, but did draw the largest gate ever, $7 million equivalent at the time in U.S. dollars, which is the largest gate ever in the history of Japanese professional wrestling, and still to this day is one of the largest gates in all of professional wrestling. On that night, Antonio Inoki retired, and he stepped down as chairman and representative director upon his retirement, but he did continue his position as the largest shareholder of New Japan and the owner. So coming out of 1998, Ricky Choshu, Antonio Inoki, two of the biggest stars in the company, still have a lot of power, still have a lot of control, but they're no longer active performers. On June 24th of 1999, Tatsumi Fujinami was appointed the president and CEO of New Japan Pro Wrestling. The former president and CEO, Seiji Sakaguchi, was appointed chairman and kind of took a more advisory senior role within the company. Now, we're going to talk about a couple major shows that took place. Now, in 2025, we know that New Japan typically runs one Tokyo Dome show on January 4th every year, like they have since the early 90s. And on occasion, they've done other January 5th shows. There was that one time during the pandemic where they ran a mid-year Tokyo Dome show. But,
you know, it's very uncommon for New Japan to run more than one Tokyo, more than one Tokyo Dome show in January. At this time, though, New Japan was running multiple major stadium shows throughout the year. And we're going to discuss those very briefly here. So on January 4th, Wrestling World in Tokyo Dome drew a reported 62,500 attendees for a gate of 5.3 million. And the two big drawing matches of that show were the ongoing feud between Naoki Ogawa and Shinya Hashimoto, as well as Kijimuto and Scott Norton for the IWGP title. On April 10th, Strong Style Symphony from the Tokyo Dome, New Japan Spirit, drew a reported attendance of 63,500. There was a tape delay rating of 6.1 on television. The two big meaningful shows, Onita and Chono in an exploding barbed wire death match, and then Fry versus Muto, an all NWO Japan main event for the IWGP title. On August 28th from Jingu Stadium, the Jingu Climax Battle of last summer, they drew 48,000 to Jingu Stadium. The two main meaningful matches being Chono versus Hashimoto and then the Great Muta versus the Great Nida in another exploding time bomb barbed wire death match. And then the last major stadium show of the year, October 11th, Final Dome. This was a show that took place one day after Hiroshi Tanahashi made his debut in New Japan Pro Wrestling. This show drew a reported attendance of 58,500 and was headlined by Kijimuto versus Manabu Nakanishi for the IWGP title. And the main event was the continuing feud between Naoki Ogawa of UFO and Shinya Hashimoto for the NWA title. Now, some of the major stories, and the reason I want to go over those numbers is just to kind of give you an idea of what the health of the company was, who some of the major stars were, what was going on in the company at that time in the world that Tanahashi was entering in with his career. Now, the major stories that were sort of playing out throughout that time, you had the NWO Japan and Team 2000 rift that was taking place. There was an ongoing invasion angle between NJPW and War, led by Genkiro Tenryu. Onita having working in a freelance capacity, leaving FMW, starting to bring in his flavor of deathmatch and barbed wire death matches into New Japan as well. Then there was the ongoing Naoki Ogawa and Shinya Hashimoto rivalry, which really kind of culminated and highlighted all throughout 1999 and 2000, would really change the shift the perspective and focus of the style of wrestling in New Japan, and was kind of the swan song for Hashimoto as a top attracting star in that company. And then finally, this was really the last active year of UFO, which was the Ultimate Fighting Organization. It was a secondary company that Inoki, as well as the original Tiger Mask, Satoru Sayama, had envisioned to sort of be the MMA branch or partner promotion of New Japan. Very similar to the original UWF idea that these two had been involved with back in the mid to early 80s. UFO really never did take off the way that they envisioned it to, and this would be the genesis of what would become Inokiism. Now, getting into 1999, the IWGP Heavyweight title, this is where we stand in terms of the longest reigns, total defenses, and most reigns. So the records that stand, and these would stand for a long time, the longest single title reign in the history of that title's history, 489 days, Shinya Hashimoto. The longest cumulative total days, 1,052, Shinya Hashimoto. The most single defenses in a single title reign, Shinya Hashimoto with 9. The most total defenses, Shinya Hashimoto with 20. So Hashimoto really has dominated the entire title picture in many ways. Kijimuto being the other major star coming out of the Musketeers, he sort of holds number 2 spot in almost every single one of these categories, not falling far behind Hashimoto. So those two guys had really dominated the 90s when it came to the title picture. But the gentleman with the most reigns up to this point, Tatsumi Fujinami, with 6 distinct title reigns. And these are title records that will hold for quite a while. And we'll get to anytime those get broken, we'll bring them up in this project. That year, the G1 winner was Manabu Nakanishi defeating Kijimuto to win the tournament. Kijimuto was the reigning IWGP champion at that time, and that entitled Manabu Nakanishi to challenge for that title, which he did unsuccessfully in the Dome show on October 11th, Final Dome. The state of the IWGP title going into 1999. So you have Scott Norton entering the year as the reigning champion. He had four defenses going into January 4th, where he defended and lost the title to Kijimuto on his fifth attempt to defend the title. Kijimuto would hold the title for the majority of the year. He would defend that title successfully on February 14th against Kensuke Sasaki, April 10th against Don Fry, May 3rd against Tenryu, July 20th against Satoshi Kojima, and then October 11th against Manabu Nakanishi. So all in all, a very lengthy and successful title reign for Kijimuto, who was a member of NWO Japan all throughout that year. On December the 10th, Kijimuto would defend and drop the title to Genichiro Tenryu, the former All Japan star, freelancer, SWS founder, War founder, one of the top draws and performers of all of the 90s. And Tenryu would gain his first and only IWGP title win at the end of the decade on Muto's sixth attempted title defense. And he would leave that year as the title holder. So let's get to Tanahashi and kind of wrap things up with his debut. So Tanahashi debuted one day before the Tokyo Dome show. That would be on October the 10th from Korakuen Hall. And this was a show that was intended to be a preview for the Tokyo Dome the next evening, where they would have a fan event. They would hold press conferences, very similar to the press conferences that we see on New Japan World today. However, they also debuted three incoming Young Lions for that show. And that would be the debuts of Katsuyori Shibata, Wataru Inoue, and Hiroshi Tanahashi. They all started on the same day. Shibata had had one junior match, which was a battle royal in the summer, but that wasn't, you know, that almost doesn't actually count in terms of his full-time career and him actually like being a debutee. This is where it really started. Tanahashi felt when he made his debut on that day that he had the best physique of anyone in the company by his debut. He was 242 pounds, a far cry from the 200 pounds that he entered the dojo at. And historically, most dojo young lions lose weight when they are going through their rigorous initial training. But Tanahashi had actually put on weight, focusing on protein and the fitness training that he'd been doing all his life. He was training three times a day, twice in the dojo and then once privately with Black Cat in preparation for his debut. His debut was in Korakuen Hall, and he felt like it was a very big deal to have your first match debut in Korakuen Hall in a well-attended show, and it definitely was. He had, there was only two matches on that show, and it was him versus Shinya Makabe. Shinya Makabe, being his senior, defeated him handedly with a Boston Crab. And that was the beginning of Hiroshi Tanahashi's in-ring career. This was a non-televised or non-broadcasted show. Tanahashi was overcome with emotion. He went to the back and he honored the long-held tradition of thanking every single senpai backstage for, you know, getting him to where he was and helping him to make his debut. Now, going back to his feelings about his physique, you know, Tanahashi debuted as a ripped individual. And if you see the picture of him on the graphic for this show itself, you can see what Tanahashi looked like in 1999, and he's just jacked to the gills. He noted that there were definitely other individuals who were maybe stronger or had a better upper body or better legs, but as a well-rounded package, he felt that there was nobody in the company who brought the the distinct full package of athleticism and physique that he did. Now, this was something he kept privately to himself. You know, it's not something you could say publicly. You'd probably get beat for that sort of thing or de-push. So still had to show humility, but that's how he was feeling. There was still that bit of like a star mentality that Tanahashi had going into his first year. Now, Tanahashi's record throughout that year was nothing to write home about. Overall, he had an overall record of 9-22. In singles matches, he was 9-21. So as you can see there, it's almost all singles matches, very little tags. So this is a little different than how we treat the Young Lions today, where they're often in tag matches with veterans. At this time, they were kind of just rotating the Young Lions that were competing against one another on the opener of shows. In his broadcast record for the year, he had 10 matches. He was 4-6, and they were all singles. With that being the case, kind of taking a look at his Young Lion contemporaries that he was competing against that year. Against Wataru Inoue, he went 4-4 that year. Against Katsuyori Shibata, he was 5-7. So a little lower than Shibata. And then with Makabe, he was 0-6. And he would not beat Makabe for several years until they were both graduated and meeting in much bigger stakes. So that kind of tells you where Tanahashi was slotted. Like, he was definitely earmarked for stardom. They had good aspirations, but in terms of the shake, in terms of the rundown, like, Shibata was a little higher than him. Makabe is a little higher than him. And he's about the same as Wataru Inoue, who would really be destined to become a junior in the long term in terms of his frame. Now, against veterans that year, he wrestled Black Cat, who was one of his trainers. He was 0-2 against Black Cat, obviously. And then the only other veteran wrestler that he wrestled that year was Tetsuhito Takaiwa. At the end of the year, there was a tradition to do a Corken Hall show with veterans versus the Young Lions to close out the year. And that's where he wrestled Tetsuhito Takaiwa, who was at the time a power junior, but was swiftly on his way to becoming a heavyweight competing junior in the following year. So he had the match with Takaiwa. He lost. That was one of his first real big tests at the end of the year. No tournaments, no title matches for Tanahashi. As we go along, that's going to change. So we'll talk more about that as time comes. Now let's talk about the matches that I'd like to review. These are both available on njpwworld.com, and I recommend that's where you go to watch them. The first match is going to be Shinya Makabe versus Hiroshi Tanahashi from November the 1st, 1999, the Fallen Black Tour, Night 13 from Hiroshima Sun Plaza. And this is a really interesting way to kind of see what the style of work was at the time, what the expectation for these guys were, and what the trajectory of Tanahashi's progression was. So Shinya Makabe, obviously being his senior, this was a stiff test for Tanahashi. The match only goes 5 minutes and 49 seconds. And a lot of the match is Tanahashi sort of getting his lunch ate by Makabe. Makabe being the senior, the bigger guy. And Tanahashi's job in this match very much so is to show that he can sell, show that he can fire up, and get the audience behind him. The early grappling exchanges between these guys in structure, it's not different than what we see from Young Lion matches today. And the match itself isn't one where I'd say you need to see it unless you're following along for this project and you're curious, but it is very interesting because while the structure of match is the same as what we see today, the style of work is very different. Makabe and Tanahashi, they're doing, you know, basic pro wrestling, but everything is a lot snugger, a lot tighter. There's a sense of realism to the style of work that was expected in New Japan at the time. And there's this sense that they are not working together. There's a struggle for every single inch that they're giving to one another. And that's something I really think is missing in professional wrestling and that I like to see out of Makabe and Tanahashi from this time. Now, again, Tanahashi is selling for a majority of the match. There is a point down the tail end where he starts to, fire back up, give some forearm exchanges. He does one of the sloppiest looking big man, drop kicks, which are expected from every single Young Lion. That was the one time in the match where the crowd does seem to react. The crowd is pretty pretty like low energy for this opener match. And that's something that's a little different. Nowadays, most of the Young Lion matches, we see the crowd being very invested regardless of who it is. But back then you kind of got the sense that these crowds were not going to get invested in these guys until they've sort of been around for a little while. And that's what we're sort of seeing here. So definitely a learning experience for Tanahashi. He eventually does get the Boston Crab on Makabe. Makabe powers out of it. And eventually Makabe is able to get him into, he hits him with the spear near fall, and then finally puts him in the key lock, or the Kimura as we know it in the West, and taps out Tanahashi 5 minutes and 49 seconds. The second match that we want to review is from the following tour in the same month, November 27th, 1999, Battle Final Night 7 from Fujisawa City, Akiba Bunka Gymnasium. And this is the first time that we'd get to see on tape Katsuyori Shibata versus Hiroshi Tanahashi. And this match goes a little longer, 7 minutes and 8 seconds. And it's a bit more of an equal affair between these guys. And as I was mentioning, the stiffness and the sense of competition, you really got that sense from Tanahashi and Shibata. Shibata is much smaller in frame and stature, but still has that fire. And Tanahashi still has a bit of the flair for theatrics and dynamicism that we've come to know from him. You can see little bits of these guys already this early in their progression. This match is one where the crowd starts off much quieter than the Makabe Tanahashi match, but as it builds, you start to see their investment grow, and they begin to really start to react to the work that's being done between these guys. So you can already see the chemistry between Katsuyori Shibata and Hiroshi Tanahashi in this match. And these guys have some really violent and very effective striking exchanges towards the tail end of the match. Ultimately, Shibata is able to beat Hiroshi Tanahashi via submission with the Boston Crab. Very similar outcome to what we saw earlier in the month with Makabe. Now, the reason I chose these two matches in particular, they're available on New Japan World, and the reality is a lot of that era's wrestling matches are not widely available. I know that, as I mentioned earlier, Tanahashi was on, multiple broadcast shows, but not all of those matches were probably broadcast. Of the 10 of them, they didn't always choose all of the matches to be broadcast, and then even if they were, some of those are lost to time or they're in the vault with TV Asahi, and people just don't have access to them. So these are the two that we do have access to, easily, readily available, and I think they're both really great picture-perfect snapshots to get an understanding of Tanahashi in the black gear, all muscled up, wrestling with his contemporaries, and seeing what he's made of. Now, we're approaching the end of the show, and two things that I noted that are a little different here than what you usually see with Young Lions today is that Tanahashi is already hitting many of the same signature or proto versions of the signature moves that he does today. Like, he's not hitting flipping sentons, but he's definitely doing a back senton that's very similar to what he does today. He's coming off the ropes and he's hitting a flying forearm to the heads of these guys. Very reminiscent to what he would eventually develop into the sling blade. When he hits an elbow drop, it's with the dramatic flair, and it's very similar to the Muto shining, elbow drop that he's known for, and you can kind of see where that influence is coming from. And then when he gets guys into Boston Crabs, instead of just putting it on traditionally, you know how when he puts on the Texas Cloverleaf and he has that kind of strange upward angle, almost Lion Tamer-esque, he's already starting to do that with his Boston Crab. These are the types of things that, generally speaking, in today's terms, you don't see from Young Lions. They're expected to go out and just wrestle the basics, and as time goes on, maybe introduce a wrinkle or two and develop over time. In 1999, these guys already had kind of developed ideas of what type of wrestlers they wanted to be, what their approaches were going to be, and were already developing these personas. So there was a little bit more freedom intended and afforded to these guys. Another interesting thing, Tanahashi had his own entrance theme music, which was pretty common at the time for guys to have their own theme music instead of just the generic Young Lion music that we know today. If you listen to the end of the show, you will hear that early first theme that Tanahashi used for his first year to 2 years of being a young lion. And it's kind of interesting to kind of hear that as well and get an understanding of where Tanahashi was. So after, you know, doing the review, we'll wrap up with a couple anecdotes here. So, you know, the thing that was kind of going on into 1999 and 2000, Tanahashi mentioned how throughout the year, especially into the next year, it would be him, Makabe, Suzuki, and Inoue and Shibata. And each night, they would rotate which of those guys would get into the bottom two matches. So usually there'd be like two men left off. So there was a fierce sense of rivalry and competition between all six of those guys throughout the early stages, or actually those five guys. So there would always be one person kind of left off. And he felt like the first real turning point of his career was a November 1999 match with Shibata, where the fans, and I don't know if it's the match that we see here. I don't think it is, because he mentioned that fans got it invested in them and he started getting chants from the audience and praise from the veterans backstage, namely Norio Honaga, who was a grizzly old veteran that typically was very, very, very critical on the wrestlers backstage, but gave them extreme props and said that they did a fantastic job. Now, Tanahashi felt like regularly backstage, he was being berated by Riki Choshu for wrestling like a grandpa, him and the other young lions being told like they didn't have enough fire, enough spirit, there wasn't enough action, and that they're wrestling slow and that they needed to be louder and noisier. Now, Tanahashi throughout this time did not feel any, he was proud and happy to be performing and to be growing and learning, but he didn't see himself as a young lion. He self-described as an arrogant, driven, self-assured, hungry, and impatient individual. And he sort of felt like he was playing the role of a young lion. And what that means is he saw himself as a future star. He envisioned himself as a star, even if those in the company didn't see it yet, and even if the fans didn't see it yet. And he felt like the black trunks, the black boots going out there in the opening matches, that was a job that was given to him, that he was pretending as a star to fit into the mold of a young lion. So he would wear the trunks, and his idea was, with my physique, with my fire, with my action, going out in the first match of the evening and firing everybody up and letting them see, oh my God, we've got, and this is kind of reminiscent of how people probably felt about Katsuyori Kitamura when he was in his prime. Seeing a guy that looks like me in just the opening match is so impressive. What does the rest of the show hold for everybody? So he knew the importance of investing the crowd, firing people up, and setting the tone for the remainder of the show. And in his mind, he almost envisioned himself as secretly carrying the company. And this kind of tells you the kind of driven sort of ego that already existed with Tanahashi, even if he was still kind of getting those criticisms and getting these instructions and being told to do and work a certain way. He had a self-assuredness about what he was doing, and he felt that he was already a destined star. That is going to wrap up our 1999. Thank you for listening to Tanahashi, Ace of the Universe, Volume 1, 1999. It's been a pleasure to bring this retrospective to you. If you want to interact with us and with me, please feel free to do so. You can reach myself as well as Jeremy. We are the hosts of Keeping It Strong Style, proud members of the Social Suplex Podcast Network. We record every Monday night, and you can find us anywhere where you get podcasts and where you choose to listen to your audio. You can also reach us on Twitter. We are at KI Strong Style. On Reddit, Jeremy is the pro black guy. I am Keeping It Strong Style. You can dialogue with us on Discord in the Social Suplex Podcast Network. Please listen to the other shows that are members of this podcast network as well. Shows like One Nation Radio, Trish and Sarah Podcast, All Things Elite, Wrestling Art with Chris Things, Tunnel Talk, and all the other great shows that we have on our network. Thank you for listening. Please give us a like, give us a download, and continue to follow us. And for the remainder of these episodes, if you want to follow along, if you want to be part of what I'm doing here, you're going to need to subscribe to our Patreon, patreon.com/KI Strong Style. and you can subscribe, and this will be available for you on the $5 tier. Thank you for your time. It's greatly appreciated. Go Ace.
Looking to buy your dream home or rent that perfect apartment? With the Redfin app, you'll know the moment your next place hits the market. Set up your gotta-have-it wish list, and Redfin will send you real-time notifications for properties that match. And when you're ready to see it in person, scheduling a tour is just a tap away. Thinking about selling? Redfin can do that too. In fact, Redfin agents close twice as many deals as other agents, so they know how to get the best price for your home. And with a listing fee as low as 1%, Redfin charges half of what others often charge. So you could save big, like really big. Last year, Redfin saved home sellers $118 million. So whether you're buying, renting, or selling, Redfin's ready to help you win. Download the Redfin app and start searching today.